The darkness of the night envelops him as he walks down the streets of Norwood. He pictures them all sleeping in their homes, completely unaware that there's a predator prowling outside. As he spots the open window, he's grateful that they're unaware, that they would never imagine what was happening in his head, even if they saw him and looked in his eyes. No one could ever guess what he has planned. And that's exactly why he's going to get away with it. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 200, The Serial Crimes of Kobus Geldenhuys. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. True Crime South Africa has partnered up with the South African Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za and support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. Episode 200. 7 years, 200 full case episodes, and more than 15 million downloads. I cannot quite believe that we've got here. But we have. And I'm so grateful to each and every one of you for your support of this podcast over the years. This has been a truly incredible journey, and I look forward to the next 200 episodes with you. This past Saturday, I did a live event on Zoom where I recorded this episode with True Crime South Africa listeners. It was a really interesting experience to do a whole episode live with listeners and then answer questions and discuss the case afterwards. If you'd like to watch that full video recording, it's up on the Patreon platform. I will definitely be doing more live events, both virtually and in person, so keep an eye out on the True Crime South Africa socials for information on that. The live stream of episode 200 was supported by Jonathan Bull Publishers, who was not only True Crime South Africa's first ever actual sponsor back in 2019, but they're now also my book publishers. And we've just released both an English and Afrikaans version of a book based on the podcast. Bare Bones and Klipkoot are out in bookstores and online right now. The case I chose to cover for episode 200 is most definitely up there with the most requested cases of all time on True Crime South Africa. It's one that's stuck in the memories of many South Africans, particularly those who lived in the general areas at the time. If you've been a long-time listener of the podcast, you'll know that South African serial killers don't match up with what we see on television, which is predominantly the US version. Our serial killers are not the faceless phantoms of our nightmares who break into our homes at night with violence on their minds. Most South African serial killers actually kill out in the open, and they're opportunistic killers who lure their victims after targeting their vulnerabilities. And that's perhaps why this individual has stuck in our minds, because he was nothing like that. He was, in fact, very similar to what we see on television, at least in his acts, and the fact that he was the very last person anyone would suspect, because his day job was to serve and protect. In researching this episode, I used a chapter from Dr. Mickey Pistorius' book, Strangers on the Street, an episode of Dr. Gerard Labuschagne's podcast, Profiler Africa, and several other sources, which have become available to me over the years through various projects. So, Let's get into episode 200, The Serial Crimes of Cobus Geldenhuys.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Now, you'll know that I usually prefer to tell the victim's story first and then the perpetrators and tie them up together at the point at which they meet. But as is so often the case with serial offence cases, it's almost impossible to do that without losing a lot of nuance. I think there's a lot more value in cases like this in telling the story as it happened, even though there's no shocking reveal at the end. That's not really the point. What I think is valuable about this method is that we get to see how the crimes change as things happen in the offender's life, which is really incredibly valuable in terms of understanding crimes of this nature. Jacobus Geldenhuys, who went by Cobus, was born into a conservative Afrikaner home. Although the Geldenhuys home was traditional in many senses of the word, the gender roles in the home certainly did not follow the norms expected for the time. Cobus's mother was described as the dominant parent and ran the home with her own strict rules, developed from her deep, lifelong commitment to the Christian religion. His father was, according to him, mostly emotionally checked out, quiet, and had little to no say in anything that happened in the home beyond his financial contribution to its running. While Corbus's own descriptions of his parents were rather lackluster, deeper investigation later would suggest that there was an element of psychological instability within his mother, and her religious beliefs were not just values, but rather deep obsessions with purity, which occasionally seemed to lead to delusional thinking, such as her belief that her home was possessed by the devil. Cobus was an only child, and although he shouldn't really have wanted for attention, he claimed that he felt invisible to both his parents, except for when his mother was trying to instill some sort of lesson in him. Cobus was a sickly child and suffered several different quite serious conditions in his primary school years. This resulted in him missing a lot of school and failing grade 5, which he had to repeat. Despite this, in his final year of primary school, he was made a prefect, but he also ended up failing that grade. The school decided that he was already too old to hold back for another year, and so he was automatically pushed up to high school. You'll hear more later about how Cobus had an odd relationship with emotions and the expression thereof. But it's quite important to note that already at this point, in primary school, that disconnection from emotions began to show. He later told interviewers that he'd started stealing from his mother's handbag and then progressed to other petty thefts around the same time because he was bored. This was the earliest instance of this correlation Cobus claimed to have with what he called being bored and committing criminal offences. And it does really seem that his parents were mostly none the wiser, because they described him as having been a quiet and well-behaved boy. Although, I will say that I have seen many other cases where the parents will initially claim there was absolutely no sign of bad behaviour in childhood, and then later, it turns out that they were very aware of it and just seemed to want to hide it so they didn't look bad. According to Cobus, there were no major issues while he was in high school, although he was almost always barely scraping through on passing. He did continue to commit random acts of theft, and according to him, two major themes continued to pervade his life: what he called boredom and loneliness. When Cobus was asked about his relationship with his mother during these years, he couldn't really describe what that relationship was like. Quite out of the blue, He mentioned that his mother would wrestle with him a lot. He wasn't quite sure what that was about, he said. It's an incredibly strange statement, considering how his mother was presented as this rather prim and proper woman of the church. In some ways, I wonder if it was simply that she was as bad as he, and seemingly his father, was at connecting on an emotional level, and this was her way of attempting to close the chasm between them. When Corbis matriculated, he applied to join the Navy. It's an odd choice for someone who didn't really seem to have any great ambition or drive in life. But it's possible that this line of work would have impressed his parents. Unfortunately, he was turned down by the Navy. I looked into some of the reasons someone may have been rejected by the Navy at that time. Although gender and race was a factor because the country was still under apartheid rule, Corbis was a white man, so that would not have been a reason in his case. A criminal record would also have had him red marked, but according to him and his parents, he'd never been in trouble with the law, despite the fact that he'd been stealing since he was in primary school. Although he was sickly as a child, there didn't seem to have been any lasting effects on him physically into adulthood, but physical and mental fitness are important requirements for the Navy, so it's possible that it was one of these two. From all the interviews that have been done with Corbis since his arrest, it's clear that he was not the greatest communicator, and I can only imagine that he would not have come across very well in an interview. Very interestingly, Corbis was also rejected by the South African Police Service, but he was then accepted into the Railway Police, which at the time was an entirely separate division from the SAPS. Corbis was stationed at Johannesburg Airport and said he found the work there to be interesting and he enjoyed it. It was around this time, though, that Corbis Kaldenhuis would commit his first serious crime. On the 12th of May 1989, Corbis was off duty and alone at his parents' house in Benoni. He said he felt bored and walked out into the backyard. He saw a ladder laying next to the wall, which his father had used the previous weekend to do some repairs, and decided that he was going to see if he could break into his neighbour's house. Now, I will say that Corbis has this way of describing his crimes that has never sat well with me. If you listen to him, it's almost as though things just happened in some sort of inevitable domino effect, and he just happened to be in the middle of it all. In this case, for instance, he doesn't share any of the steps he may have taken before making this decision, nor does he explain that he'd likely done this before. It doesn't really make sense to me that he would just randomly jump over a wall to burgle a house without first maybe checking whether his neighbour's car was in the driveway. He probably did take some action like that, of course, but if he were to include that in his narrative, it would have detracted from this feeling of everything just happening around him rather than him actually being the driving force. I will also say that these are his descriptions of the crimes, and they are combined with a little bit of what was taken from the case files. He claims that that day, he'd propped the ladder up against his parents' neighbour's wall and climbed over. As he dropped onto the other side, the homeowner's domestic worker, 21-year-old Franiswa Tunzi, was coming out of the room that she lived in. She saw Corbis and screamed. He immediately pushed her inside her room and punched her in the stomach in an attempt to silence her. Corbis claims that Franiswa continued to struggle, so he grabbed a brick that was under her bed and struck her in the head. Corbis admits that he'd been thinking about raping a woman prior to this, but in his retelling of this crime, he does not admit to raping Franiswa. He said he strangled her until she was dead, and then he set fire to papers and books that were in her room and pushed them onto her body. Again, at no point does Kobus talk about any sexual attack here. But when Franiswa's body was found, she was naked from the waist down. Unfortunately, Franiswa's case presents a stark example of how differently black and white victims were treated by police during apartheid. Very little actual detection work was done at the scene. There were no clear notes in her autopsy to show whether she'd been checked for sexual assault. And honestly, it doesn't even look like much of an investigation was launched into her murder, because Kobus claimed that after he'd fled back to his home, he decided that if police came knocking about her murder, he would confess. But despite him being a direct neighbour to the murder scene, not a single police officer ever arrived at the Geldenhuys home to ask whether the family had been home that day or seen or heard anything of relevance. Franiswa's murder was a vital opportunity to stop a man who was about to become a vicious serial killer. But he slipped right through the police's fingers. And several more women were about to pay the price. After Franiswa's murder, Kobus said he was able to keep what he called the thing under control for almost 2 years. But what happened during those 2 years is also telling as to how he managed to do that. Kobus attended church with his parents almost every Sunday, and on one occasion he met a young woman called Nadine. Many sources describe Nadine as having an intellectual disability, and it's likely this may have been something that drew Kobus to her. She was, perhaps, in his eyes at least, a woman who would be no threat to him. The way they met speaks to much more, too. Kobus says that after seeing Nadine at church a few times, one Sunday he sat down in the pews behind her, and during the service he pulled a pin out of his pocket and stabbed her in the bum with it, because apparently just tapping her on the shoulder and saying hello was too much of a stretch for him. Nadine had swiveled around in surprise, and he held the pin up for her to see. She seemed to think it was funny, and the ice was broken. Nadine's father had never been much of a fan of Kobus, but the pair managed to continue on a relationship with his blessing. They would eventually become engaged, too. This relationship likely kept Kobus distracted for some time. He was also experiencing some changes in his work, which would eventually lead to a shift that undoubtedly played a huge role in what was to come. Although Kobus Geldenhuys had been rejected by the SAPS, he eventually got in, quite by chance. The railway police was merged with the SAPS, and it seems the police just accepted each railway member in without any additional background checks, because no one seemed to flag that Kobus had already been passed over for a position there. After the merge, Kobus continued to be posted at the airport for a while, but then he was transferred to the Internal Stability Unit in Alexandra Township. And as an unmarried police officer, he was given a space in the barracks in Norwood. In apartheid South Africa, the Internal Stability Unit, despite its mild-sounding title, was essentially tasked with violent crowd control and the armed suppression of citizens. For the most part, these crowds were black South Africans protesting the various injustices forced upon them by apartheid authorities. Many, many stories of violence, abuse, and murder were told about members of these riot squads in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission years later. Most of the ex-police officers I've spoken with who were assigned to these squads say their worst memories of policing are from this time in their career. Alexandra at the time was a particular hotspot for protests and violence from riot squads. But Kobus found the job, and you'll probably guess what his description was, boring. When asked whether he'd experienced any traumatic incidents during this time, he said there was a lot of stuff that happened, but he didn't find any of it traumatic. He did get something out of this post that he really liked, though. Kobus Geldenhuys was given a gun. And while it would take some time for him to get around to using it in his crimes, he later openly admitted that this was a turning point for him. Up until then, he'd still felt like he could be easily overpowered while committing crimes. The gun, however, empowered him. He felt invincible. And now he could do whatever he wanted to. There are often triggers for the start or escalation of violence with serial offenders. And for Kobus, receiving the gun was one of them. The other came in October 1991, when just a few weeks before he and Nadine were set to be married, he and her father got into a huge argument because her dad didn't feel that Kobus was doing anything to set up a life for them. Kobus refused to take his sergeant's exam, which would help them to get a police flat together. He had no plan as to how they would live together once they were married. Kobus ended up slamming the phone down in the man's ear, and the wedding was called off. About a month later, on the 2nd of November 1991, Kobus went for a walk and saw an open window in a flat in a building near the barracks. He climbed through the window and stole some CDs. The next night, he was out again. He found another open window and climbed into the flat of Ms. F. He stole some CDs, a CD player, and two speakers. As he was leaving, he saw her car keys laying on a table. He decided to take her car for a joyride. Upon his return, he parked the car back in its spot and tossed the car keys through the window. This was a clear escalation from Kobus, and for the next 3 days, the increased level of rush he'd experienced sat with him, and he pondered. He would later admit that rape had always been on his mind as something that he wanted to do. Now, armed with a gun, he had the ultimate form of control, life and death. And on the 6th of November, he chose to use it. Just a reminder that the surviving rape victims have been anonymized to protect their identities. On the night of the 6th, Kobus returned to Miss F's flat. He walked into her bedroom with his gun drawn, and she woke up. Miss F begged him not to hurt her, but he pushed a gun into her face and told her to get undressed. The terrified woman did as she was told, and Kobus proceeded to rape her. In his retellings of his crimes, Kobus was always keen to highlight how many times his victims had begged him not to hurt or kill them. After the rape, he claimed Ms. F. once again begged for her life, and he told her to cover her face with her duvet. She did so. He got dressed, yanked the telephone cord out of the wall, and climbed back out of the window. After this crime, Kobus waited another 20 days to commit the next. On the 26th of November, he again said that he'd felt bored sitting at the barracks and went on a walk. It starts to become clear that this thing Kobus calls boredom is not what most others experience as boredom. For him, that feeling was his baseline. A sense of not experiencing anything, really, because most human experiences seemed like a foreign language to him. He learned that the crimes gave him a spike in adrenaline and other stress hormones, which it seems, to him, resonated as not just a physiological experience, but a psychological one too. An experience as close to an emotional one he might ever have. But the more he got away with the pettier crimes, the thefts from his mom's handbag, and then the thefts from Holmes, the less his brain responded to those events. So he had to do more to achieve the same sense of feeling. All that is without factoring in the desire he had for control, which had also started to escalate and became all-consuming once he had the gun. Life and death in his hands. On the night of the 26th, Corbus left the barracks twice. The first time, he spotted a window to 68-year-old Mrs. M's flat open. Her handbag was standing on a table near enough to the window for him to reach. She was sitting in the lounge watching television, and he stole 50 rand out of her bag while she was just steps away. He returned to his barracks and waited until he thought Mrs. M would likely be asleep, and then he went back to her flat. The window was still open, and he climbed through. She screamed as he walked into her bedroom, and he pistol-whipped her. He raped Mrs. M twice that night. After the first rape, he asked for money, and when she said she didn't have any, he raped her a second time. Then he threw the blankets over her and left the flat. On the 16th of December, another 20 days later, Corbus spent the night after work watching a home he knew quite well in Norwood. It wasn't particularly far from the barracks, and it would emerge that he'd actually been invited to a bra there once. He'd also previously broken into that home and walked around it, although he hadn't stolen anything on that evening. He knew that the house was a commune, and two women and a man lived there. That night, he entered through a sliding door on the side of the house. He hadn't seen the man at the house at all, which had been comforting to him, and any fears he'd had about the man being a threat were further allayed when he checked the bedroom he knew was his and found it empty. Corbus then made his way to the bedroom he knew belonged to 27-year-old Julia Hitka. Corbus would claim that what happened next was merely as a result of him having to take evasive action after Julia had seen his face, and he knew that she could identify him. He would use this excuse in other cases too, claiming that once the light in a room came on and the victim saw his face, he had no choice but to kill her, as though this was just an inevitable consequence, almost totally out of his control. But the one fact he frequently sidestepped was that it was him who would turn the light on, not his victims. That night, Corbus raped Julia and then shot her in the side of the head. He pulled the duvet up to her chin, stole some money from her purse, switched off the light, and closed the door behind him. Her body would only be discovered at 5 p.m. the next day, when her roommate realized that she hadn't gone to work, knocked on her bedroom door to see if she was okay, and discovered the scene of horror. Of course, this was not the first time Corbus Haldenhaes had killed someone, but it was the first time he'd done so with a gun, and it had happened after a period of progression from several rapes. This was clearly a point of major progression for him, because after this, the cooling-off period between his crimes significantly decreased. Just 2 weeks later, Corbus again left the barracks at night, and this time he went just next door. Scaling the barracks wall, he entered a residence in the block of flats next door. There he found 27-year-old Jennifer Matfield asleep in her bed. She woke to him, naked and looming over her. She tried to scream and get away, but he pistol-whipped her and raped her. After the rape, she asked if she could use the toilet, and he agreed. While she was in the bathroom, he told her that he wanted her to take a bath. While he never said that this was the reason, I suspect that by now He'd started to hear that police were collecting evidence in the crimes he'd committed. The rapes and murders had by now started to be spoken about as possibly being the work of the same person, and it was all the talk in the Norwood barracks. It would later emerge that detectives actually already suspected that someone from the barracks was committing the crimes. They'd collected fingerprints from one scene, and Corbis had been made aware that a team would be coming out to fingerprint everyone in the barracks to rule them out. He also knew that his semen from the rapes may have been collected. Although DNA was not yet a tool in use, blood typing was, and I have to wonder if this is perhaps why he forced Jennifer to bathe. Corbis then claimed that while she was in the bath, he'd raised his firearm and pointed it at her. He said she'd looked at him and then looked away. And as she did, he'd shot her in the back of the head. This is another pattern with Corbis. He often likes to present his victims as being calmly resigned to their fate. And I find it quite difficult to believe that Jennifer would have simply looked away after seeing the gun pointed at her. What is more likely is that Corbis had specifically positioned himself behind her and cold-bloodedly shot her in the back of the head. After Jennifer's body was discovered, police found footprints leading from the barracks over the wall and into her home. Impressions of these were taken, and it further solidified the belief that it was a resident of the barracks that was committing the crimes. The fingerprinting of the barracks residence was arranged, but Corbis simply didn't attend, and no one ever followed up with him. By this point, Norwood was abuzz with the news of a serial killer in their midst. Women in the neighbourhood were understandably terrified. Some moved out entirely. Others brought male friends and relatives to stay with them. Sales of security devices skyrocketed, and Corbis quickly realised that it had become too risky for him to continue. He claimed that during this time he would always make sure he had his firearm close by, and his plan was that if they came to arrest him, he would shoot himself before they could take him into custody. The investigation had determined that the fingerprints from the scenes matched each other, as did the blood type from the semen collected from the victims. The blood type was O positive, and this, among other criteria, was being used to whittle down a list of suspects the investigating officer, Warrant Officer Miles of Norwood SAPS, was working with. Was his hunting ground now too hot to handle? In January 1992, Corbis put in for a transfer to the East Rand. This was granted, and he moved back in with his parents in Benoni. Although he and Nadine's engagements had been called off, he was still seeing her. And on the 2nd of May 1992, after leaving her home, Corbis's long cooling-off period came to a screeching halt. Just two houses down from Nadine's parents' home, 74-year-old Susanna Vandrach was asleep in her bed when Corbis Heldenhuis made entry into her home, switched the light on to wake her up, and then pistol-whipped her in the face. Corbis would later say that he couldn't bring himself to rape such an elderly woman, so he'd shot her in the face. He then sat in Susanna's lounge for several hours before leaving. On the 15th of July 1992, Corbis was alone at his parents' house when he decided he was bored. He went for a walk, and two houses down from his parents, he noticed a door standing open and decided to jump over the wall into the neighbour's yard. As he did so, one of the residents, 16-year-old Veronica Taylor, was coming out the door. She screamed when she saw him, and he pulled his gun and shoved her back inside the house. Again, in Corbis's retelling of the story, he always makes things sound more random than they probably were, because I'm quite certain he'd already scoped the house out a bit better than he claimed, and he knew Veronica was home alone with her mother just having left to go to the shops. Either way, with Veronica inside the house, he forced her at gunpoint into her parents' bedroom. There, thinking that he wanted money, the young girl gave him 150 rand from her mother's cupboard. Corbus took it and then pushed her down onto the bed. He attempted to rape her, but he was unable to penetrate her. He did, however, ejaculate on the scene. Corbus then shot Veronica in the forehead. Quite importantly, in terms of progression, at this scene, Corbus began to experiment with staging his victims. Where previously he'd covered up most of his victims with their duvets, he knew very well that Veronica's parents would be home shortly and they would find their daughter. He staged her body and left the house keys he'd picked up placed on top of her. It is perhaps a terribly sad irony that Corbus's first and last murder scenes would be just meters from his parents' home. A detective from Benoni, Warrant Officer Null, was assigned to Veronica's case. And by a stroke of luck, the forensic pathologist who performed her autopsy had also done the autopsies on the other victims in the series. He immediately alerted Warrant Officer Null that he suspected his case was linked to the Norwood series, and Null got in contact with Miles. A few officers had transferred from Norwood to the East Rand in the beginning of that year, and both detectives firmly believed they would find their suspect among those men. By using the evidence they had, including the blood type, they narrowed down their list to a few officers. Corbus Geldenhuys was on that list, but he was not the prime suspect, because his blood type was A positive, while the semen samples had tested as O positive. On the 21st of July 1992, Warrant Officer Miles set out to the East Rand Internal Stability Unit to interview one of the men on the list. When he discovered that the officer was not there, he asked for Corbus Geldenhuys. When Corbus received a message that Miles was there to see him, he immediately knew what he was there for. Before heading down to speak to the detective, Corbus slipped into the armory and swapped out his own firearm for another. As the interview began, Miles immediately noticed that Corbus seemed nervous. As part of ordinary record keeping, he asked Corbus for his full name and current address. When Corbus provided his parents' address, Miles quickly recognized that this was the same street that Veronica Taylor lived on. Miles asked Corbus whether he knew anything about the girl's murder, and Corbus started to squirm in his chair, but insisted he knew nothing. Then Corbus shut down and refused to answer any more questions. This was, of course, highly suspicious, so Miles placed him under arrest, seized his firearm, and took his fingerprints. The fingerprints were rushed through, and within hours, Miles had confirmation. It was a match. He brought Corbus back in from the cells and told him the news. Likely realizing that there was no way out of his predicament, Corbus confessed. He also told Miles that the gun he'd seized was not actually his, and when his real firearm was recovered from the armory, ballistics, of course, matched back to each of the murder victims. Of course, at no point during the series did police ever consider Franiswa Tunzi's murder to be linked. Corbus would eventually tell them about her case. The only piece of evidence that remained up in the air was the blood type analysis, which didn't fit Corbus. In a pretty wild circumstance, it emerged that Corbus Geldenhuys was part of a really tiny portion of the population whose blood type in their blood is different from the blood type in their semen. I don't really want to know how they figured this out, but tests would later confirm that Corbus's blood type was A positive and his semen blood type was O positive. The vast majority of people in Corbus's life could not believe what he'd done. He was taken in for psychiatric assessments, and although a full panel of psychologists could not find any diagnosable conditions and found him fit to stand trial, a criminologist for the defense found that he may have had schizoid affective disorder, and part of their defense would be that his behavior had been influenced by low serotonin levels in his brain. Ultimately, the judge did not buy into this, and Corbus Geldenhuys was found guilty of 5 counts of murder, 3 counts of rape, and an array of other charges, including robbery. In September 1993, when he was sentenced, the death sentence was still in effect, and he was handed down 5 death sentences for the murders. Although the death penalty was still on the table at that point, most executions had been stayed for some time, as it became clear that the death penalty would likely soon be abolished. This did happen shortly after Corbus was incarcerated and his death sentences were commuted to life. Over the years that followed, many psychologists and criminologists interviewed Corbus Geldenhuys in prison. I've personally spoken with several of them. Almost all had a similar takeaway. The man saw emotions as foreign concepts. He viewed his crimes as unfortunate consequences of his boredom and loneliness. But his experience of boredom and loneliness were not what others necessarily experience. Geldenhuys has been eligible for parole for quite some time now, but on each occasion he has been denied. All psychological reports relating to these parole hearings have highlighted a huge risk in releasing him due to the extreme level of psychopathic traits he has. Geldenhuys himself has admitted at times that he doesn't really see how he might have changed between when he entered prison and when he was being assessed for parole. The idea of rehabilitation does not really make sense to him. Over the last 7 years, I've interacted with a lot of people who have had connections to this case. The most impactful of those interactions have been with people who knew the victims. I'm never surprised when, even 3 decades later, someone is still deeply impacted by the loss of someone they cared for through violent crime. The ripples of these cases are deeply felt long after even the perpetrator is dead and buried. And this is what we need to remember when we say things like, "This happened so long ago, why are we bringing it up again?" For those who loved the victims, and for the surviving victims, it was not 30 years ago. It was yesterday, and today, and it will be tomorrow too. Franice Watunzi, Julia Hitka, Jennifer Matfield, Susanna Vandrach, Veronica Taylor, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.